You're listening to TIP.
Then you should absolutely chase that, because let me just tell you, it's one of the best decisions I've ever made in my entire life. I'm very uncomfortable. I speak like a robot. I'm very slow to speak. And that, even that was me having experienced my previous channel. And that's how bad I was at the beginning. But I still just had this dream or this idea of what this could mean for my life. And I think that if you're going to chase that, it has to be more than just, it's going to make me a lot of money. It's got to be something you actually like think is going to be just a blast to do. But if you have ever had that thought and you aren't doing at least something to act on it, you're doing yourself a great disservice, because the last thing you want in your life is to be 80 years old in your deathbed and looking back on things with major regret.
Hey guys, in today's episode, I had the pleasure of sitting down and talking with your friend Andy to discuss how he worked his way out of significant debt and became a millionaire before his 40th birthday. You'll learn what steps Andy took to dig himself out of debt, the first money moves he recommends for someone that's in financial trouble, why it's never too late to get started, why you need to make asymmetric bets to build wealth, how Bitcoin has become an important part of his portfolio, and a whole lot more. Andy's a lifelong entrepreneur, but he was never any good with money. At age 29, he had racked up $86,000 in credit card debt and was living paycheck to paycheck. He had no savings or investments, yet 10 years later, he's erased that debt and became a millionaire. For the past 3 years, he's been a creator on YouTube, initially talking mostly about personal finance, but now more solidly focused on Bitcoin and passive income. I've been following Andy's content for over 3 years, and I've learned a ton from him. I hope you guys do too. And so, without further delay, let's dive into today's episode with your friend Andy.
Celebrating 10 years, you are listening to Millennial Investing by the Investors Podcast Network. Since 2014, we interviewed successful entrepreneurs, business leaders, and investors to help educate and inspire the millennial generation. Now for your host, Patrick Donnelly.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Millennial Investing Podcast. I'm your host today, Patrick Donnelly, and joining me in today's studio is my friend Andy. Andy, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I am really happy to have you on here. I mentioned before we got started recording that I've been a big fan of yours and your content, YouTube content, for, I don't know, probably 3 years ago, I remember following you. And I'm happy to just have you on here today. We're going to talk a bunch about a lot of different topics. But the first thing I wanted to go into is some of like your early days. Like, you got into a little bit of a financial pickle. I think you were in debt like $86,000 or something like that. I wanted to talk about just some of those early money mistakes you made, and then just your quest for financial literacy and digging yourself out of that hole.
Yeah. So when it comes to like my personal finance journey, one, the first thing you need to know about me is I'm a late bloomer. I talk to people online, me being a part of on Twitter and YouTube and whatever. I meet all these people who are very young and already investing into this. I was doing any of that. Into my 20s, I was just, credit cards were just disposable, you know, scan it anywhere you want, no big deal. Racked up the debt. I had no investments to speak of. I was living paycheck to paycheck. My salary wasn't great. There was no inheritance coming my way. I've never received one. There's no like saving grace, no saving throw. So I had this kind of just a bunch of bad decisions compounding over the decade known as my 20s. And then at 29, I guess I finally decided to like awaken and grow up a little bit. But I kept having panic moments. There's nothing quite like not being able to pay your bills or worrying where your next dollar is coming from or whatever, to just like on a regular basis to just set this anxiety inside of you. And I just got, me and my wife were just fed up with it. We're just like, this has got to change. And so I started investigating how I could change that and fix that. And the very first thing I ever read was I Will Teach You to Be Rich by Ramit Sethi. And looking back, you know, do I agree with every single thing he outlines in that book now? No, but it was a great starting place for me to say, hey, here's what you can do with your money. Here's how you can manage it. Here's some places to invest it. Here's what investing does. And it showed me the 25-year-old versus the 35-year-old, both starting from zero, and what it looks like in the future, and how much that extra decade of compounding is like, you know, you can smoke that, you know, that other comparison there. And so I opened a Roth IRA and started investing and started thinking about how I could better manage my money. And then slowly but surely got to where I am today, which is in a much better financial footing. But I do not miss those early anxiety riddled days of my finance journey at all.
Was your wife on board with this? Was she part of this journey too, of like financial education? And was she reading Ramit's book and other books that you guys might have been into?
She's on the same page in terms of we need to make a change here. she's never been really into the finance. Like I geek out about it now and I've really enjoyed learning about it and reading about it. She was never doing those things, but I guess I lucked out or chose well, depending on how you want to view it, choosing my wife, and that she is a very frugal person. Whereas I obviously for a long time was not. She took a real risk there jumping in with me. But you know, when I'm like, hey, we need to do these things right off the bat, she was equipped to do this kind of change of pace with me. And so she was able to use that kind of saving mindset and stuff and let's be frugal and be careful how we spend our money. And then I'm just learning as I go and she's just being supportive of it. So yeah, it's nice like kind of partnership in doing that, but it wasn't both of us were trying to drive the financial ship at the same time. It was just some complementary ingredients there.
You mentioned I Will Teach You to Be Rich. Were there other books that were influential at the time that as you started your learning journey, they were books that like made a big impact on you?
That was the biggest, and I don't even remember how I found that book. I probably typed best personal finance book into Google or something and found it. And then I started reading Ramit's blog and stuff and really liked the way he talked about personal finance. I was given Dave Ramsey's Total Money Makeover at one point. I did read most of that. Dave did not resonate with me as much. But I will say, being on this side of things, I'm not anti-credit card. I'm not anti-debt. But I really appreciate that perspective when you're in a place where you can't control it, or if you just never can in the future, then I see a lot of merit to it. But yeah, on this side of it, that I've learned how to control these things, I think some of that stuff is a little bit silly, but I think it also has a real place for certain people, and just ignoring my credit cards and basically cutting them up was a kind of a big step in the right direction for me in the kind of early stages of the journey.
Did you ever get into Mr. Money Mustache? Was he a guy that made an impact on you at all?
Later, not in the early stages, but yeah, we first got out of debt and started doing investing and things like that and saving and budgeting and all this stuff. And then I kind of got introduced to the whole FIRE movement and this whole retire early idea, financially independent, retire early. And I had never heard of that. And of course, if you're going to search that stuff online, you're going to find Mr. Money Mustache and others. And I was intrigued by it. I will say it did not resonate with me in terms of what they would call like lean FIRE and stuff. I'd be more the fat FIRE kind of a person, because some people, they truly figure out what their absolute minimum is to just stop everything and retire right now. And they're perfectly happy to live that really frugal lifestyle. And I can respect that and I appreciate that. But one of the things that I want my wealth to do for me is buy some comfort, but also buy me like time freedom to travel wherever we want, whenever we want, or to go to nice restaurants and stuff like that. I do like the idea of retire early, but it would definitely be more on the luxurious side of retire early if I was going to pursue that.
Let's go into a scenario. Like there's somebody listening to this, they're in debt, 50, 60, whatever the number is, $60,000. I remember at 25, looking at that same chart where it's like, oh, I hadn't started saving much at all. And, you know, you compare that to if you wait till 35, I started to feel like I'm behind the eight ball already. Like I haven't gotten started. I need to get started. So let's say there's somebody in their 20s listening to this, they're in debt. What are some just like first money moves that you would recommend to them to make to start kind of building, scratching, clawing their way out of that situation they're in?
Well, I'm a realist, first of all, and the harsh reality, if you are in that situation, you're 35 and you haven't quite got started on financial journey, is it would have been a lot better if you'd started earlier. It would have been better if dumb young Andy hadn't waited till 29 to start on my financial journey. If I had started at 19, the world would be wildly different for me personally if I'd done that. That's a reality. However, I also simultaneously believe that, and I truly believe this because I feel like I'm a walking testament to this, and I've seen others who are even older than me who have started from zero and who are a testament to this, that it's truly never too late if you start. I mean, the worst thing you can do is just sit on the sidelines and continuously like weigh your options, or worse yet, you go, oh, I'll do it tomorrow, or I'll do it next month, or I'll get on that next year, because that just never happens. So the first thing to do is just reality check where you're at and then go, okay, this is fixable, savable, and then to start breaking it down into as small of pieces as possible. And for me and my wife, that was literally the most boring and mundane and everyone's least favorite thing when it comes to personal finance, which was just budgeting. Because if you don't know where your money is going and what it is doing, you're going to be clueless about taking control of that situation. So we used YNAB, which I love YNAB.
Which is, what does that stand for? You need a budget.
And it's a little bit of a different way to go about budgeting. You put your money to work ahead of time and then you spend out of those buckets and stuff. It's kind of like the envelope system, but digitally with the few caveats. It resonated with us once we got over the learning curve, and it really helped us take control of that. But taking control of your spending is huge, because you might already be in a surplus if you can take control of your spending and have a little bit of extra to start making some good like future moves. If you do the budgeting stuff, you realize you're still at paycheck to paycheck, which is where we were. Then the next step, in my opinion, is just use the one thing you probably have some abundance of in terms of assets, which is time, and just start trading your time for money. I did every side hustle imaginable. I Ubered and Lyfted, and I did helped people with handyman tasks. I did photography on the side. I did video editing freelance, anything I could to earn extra money to take my salary and then expand that so I have some extra capital to start working with. And I had to give up a lot of like social time with friends and hanging out and stuff like that. But it's like such a short-term sacrifice. If you can really get the ball moving, then eventually you can start enjoying all that stuff. But if you never do that, you never get to enjoy that stuff without being like constantly in a panic attack mode, because you know your money's not going very far. So take control of your money, figure out where it's going, and then figure out a way to make more money so you can start like putting it to work.
So what was your full-time job at the time? You're doing these side gigs, but what were you doing full-time?
As a creative director at a software startup here in Austin. And when I was doing these side hustles and things, I would do this when, you know, I got home, but also I was trying to start my business, which I've done for the past 10 years, which was a photography business. And I would, on all my lunch breaks, I would go to the, because it was a startup, and so they were still building out the building. There's an unfinished side. I would take my lunch and I'd go sit in one of the unfinished conference rooms on the other side of the building, sit on the floor and get on my phone while I'm eating my sandwich or whatever, and call potential clients that I can try to convince me to hire me to be a photographer for this event or that thing. And I was trying to simultaneously, while working my normal 9-to-5 job, build the side business. And then when I got home, I would do more of that, and I'd edit photos or I'd go shoot. And then all my weekends were just spent photographing. And then free time, when I wasn't photographing or doing the job, I'd be driving for Uber and Lyft or whatever. I was just trying to make as much money as I possibly could on top of my normal salary, so I could just put it to work and clear at the debt and start investing and start actually feeling like I'm a little bit ahead of the game, whereas I've been so far behind that entire time.
Was your wife also doing side gigs at the same time you were doing your hustles?
Yeah, not as aggressively. I was definitely the really aggressive one with that. But, you know, the photo business is something we both did together, and that was on top of her full-time job at the time. But she's always like flip stuff on eBay and Craigslist, and she will go shopping for vintage clothes at Goodwill and clean it up and steam it and fix it and then sell it on Poshmark or eBay or whatever. So yeah, she has done a lot of that, just not, I kind of went crazy with it because I was all of a sudden super motivated, but group effort.
So how long did it take you to pay off that? It was $86,000 worth of debt. How long did it take you to pay that off? And were you, I kind of wanted to hear about how you did this. Were you investing at the same time, or were you strictly trying to pay that debt off before you even got started in investing?
So the first thing we did was we tried to build up a little bit of an emergency fund. And at the time it was very meager. It was like $1,000 or $2,000 or something like that. Just something that when the tire on the car explodes again, or have an emergency like doctor thing or whatever, we have a little bit of money that we don't have to use, swipe the credit card. So once we built that up, we were almost solely focused on debt because I was just so fixated on that. But then as I was reading I Will Teach You to Be Rich and probably some stuff online, and people are just talking about the importance of retirement and this magical thing called the Roth IRA, we then focus on just saving up $5,000, which at the time was the minimum to open a Vanguard Roth IRA. And I opened one for me, and then we did it again and opened one for her. And then we were just back to debt attack. But the debt, I think it took us, it's a little less than 3 years, like 2.5 years, just throwing everything in the kitchen sink at it and working around the clock to knock it out.
And then the Roth, were you investing in index funds?
It was a target date retirement fund, which in hindsight, I picked that because it was just like the Vanguard recommended thing. It was very non-aggressive, and the exposure to like the S&P 500 was also not like huge. It still has like bonds and stuff in there. And so in hindsight, I probably would have just thrown it all into S&P 500, but I did that. So it didn't quite grow as quickly early on as it maybe could have. But yeah, now it's all S&P 500 basically.
At what stage of the game did you realize, like, you know, that you talked about FIRE, at what point were you like, this is realistic, I could leave my regular full-time job? When did that start to become a reality, and how did it become a reality?
So that became a reality while I was doing all these side hustles, the thing is I was building that side business, and the side business kept growing and growing until I was making the same at my side business that, you know, I just had the extra time I had left over. I built that thing, was making as much as my full-time job, and I didn't want to do my full-time job anymore. I wanted to not have a boss. I wanted to be my own boss. And because my entire life, I've been an entrepreneur. Elementary school, junior high school, starting all my own little businesses, did all kinds of crazy things in college. But just before college, I kind of got this, I was kind of convinced that you go to college, you get a degree, you get a job.
You followed the script.
So I did that. Yeah, I followed the script. And then as I was executing on the script at my job, I'm like, why am I doing it? So jump ship to do my own thing. And then I just poured money into investments and stuff. And that's when I started seeing like what the potential was and the possibility was. And then I think that's probably about the time I encountered the idea of retire early and how you calculate, you know, percentage drawdown on those investments and what they could look like in terms of like an annualized salary and what those numbers need to be to have a certain amount. And oh, wow, if I do this for X number more years, work could be optional if I decide I don't want to do my own thing anymore. And that was a very exciting prospect.
Let's go into like calculating some of those numbers a little bit. You're familiar with the 4% rule, right? Mm-hmm. Can you explain that to our listeners? I love the 4% rule. I like to think about it all the time. Not all the time, but it's a fun calculation to do. Can you talk about that and just how I think about it in your own life?
Yeah, sure. I think it's the Trinity study is what it's called, what this number is based off of. But essentially the idea is if you're putting your money into your investment account, you're investing into stocks or index funds or whatever, of that entire giant amount of money, there's a certain percentage that you can take out of it on a yearly basis and live off of, and you will never diminish the main amount. It will perpetually grow into the future. And the reason this works is because if you take the S&P 500, for example, which is just a collection of the 500 largest companies by their market cap size in the US, if you buy into that index fund, that's that, you know, the picture of the US stock market, over the past 100 years or whatever it's existed, it's returned on average 8 to 10% a year. Now, some years it's down 7%, and other years it's up 23%. Over 100 years, it's averaged at 8%. And so the idea is if you were invested in something like that and you draw out 4% from it, there's still another 4% over time that it continues to grow, and it will perpetually grow and you can still live off of it. Now, I think that study, there is a certain scenarios where it doesn't do as well. So some people who are really conservative don't do 4%, they do 3% or they do 2%. But there are, you know, kind of calculated ways you can take money out of these investments you've worked so hard to build up, live off of them, and still have more money than you did before.
Yeah, I love it. It's fun to think about how much you need per year to live on and then figure out, all right, here's what nest egg I need to make to withdraw 4%. And then I'm good. There's a guy, an investor I like, Nick Sleep is his name. We mentioned Clay Fink, my colleague, who he's really into Nick Sleep, who was a hedge fund manager. And he was a value investor, but he had this idea of like an X number where after a certain amount of time of his investing career, once he hit this X number, he was going to be done. And he actually did it. He shut down this fund. He told his investors, invest in Amazon, Costco, and Berkshire Hathaway. That's what I'm going to do. And he was done like at 40 something. Is that something you think about for yourself where you've got this number and it's like, if I hit that, I can stop doing everything? Or do you enjoy all the, like, for me, I would think it would be hard to quit a game that you've excelled at, like this guy, Nick Sleep. He was an excellent investor and he just stopped. I wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's two aspects. One, when I'm talking about the 4% rule, you know, you can dream up what your scenario is going to be. You can say, if I want to live on 100 grand per year, or if I want to live on $200,000 or $250,000 per year, that is 4% of what number? And that's, you know, your end goal number. So you can kind of dream up and think about whatever, what's that big number, that big shiny object you can chase. And yeah, I mean, I do have, it changes all the time. You know, it's been like $10 million, right, like $20 million or something. And maybe I'll hit those things and I'll actually want to stop doing whatever. But I'm having a lot of fun with all the things I'm doing now. And I think it's exciting, the idea of hitting a certain number and quitting and doing whatever you want. It's a great dream. But I also think it's just as exciting to hit that number or whatever, and for that, for work and all things to be totally optional. And that's exciting in and of itself. And then still doing something else that makes money if you want to, or for fun, or do it for a little while, take big swaths of time off and go travel or whatever, and then come back to it. That's one of the things I love about investing and building wealth and whatever is, it gives you options. It buys back your time effectively. And if you can do it successfully enough, like, that's just, I don't know, it's just such a freeing, calming anxiety cure in my mind to know that at any given point, at the drop of a hat, I can say, I'm going to take the next year off and there's no consequence to me whatsoever.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey, everyone. It's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guy's trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash, whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise flagship fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/millennialinvesting. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise flagship fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
Hey guys, when it comes to financial advice, you've got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever credit card was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? A free flight to a bucket list destination? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and much more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Check out nerdwallet.com and start making smarter financial decisions. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
Tim Ferriss has got the idea of taking mini retirements. And I've always thought, yeah, since reading the 4-hour work week, I thought that's, yep, a great idea. And you just took one. You went to Japan. You had mentioned that you had gone, mm-hmm, to Japan. It's great to have that flexibility to just be able to be like, nope, I'm going to take a couple, 2-3 weeks and go visit Japan.
Yes. Yeah, there's, in the world of online gurus and personal finance stuff, there this phrase thrown around, lifestyle design. And for some people, it has a like negative connotation and it's kind of frou-frou or whatever. Right. But I'm a big believer in it in just the practical sense, in that if once upon a time, if I want to take a vacation, I had to ask someone's permission to do so. I had to put in for time off or whatever. And that's not the case with every 9-to-5 job. And I'm not anti 9-to-5, but you have to answer to somebody. You have a boss who's going to tell you what to do, and you have to work towards whatever their vision is for the company or whatever. And I just don't want any of that. Mm-hmm. I just want to decide what's important to me, and I want to chase that thing on my time and with whatever amount of motivation or lack of motivation, depending on what day it is, I want to throw at that problem. But I also want to, on a Tuesday, go to the movies, mm-hmm, or the following Thursday, me and my wife decide, oh, let's go to Japan, or let's go to a different state. Let's go. Or just a few weeks ago, I went just skiing with my dad. I like having that freedom to do those things. And that's a money thing, mm-hmm, but that's also just like a lifestyle design and like being my own boss thing. Money helps with that whole situation, but also just like cutting all the constraints, all the rules. And yeah, I'm not lawless. I can't, right, do whatever I want, but getting outside of working for a company or having to ask permission or whatever gives you a certain level of extra freedom, which I treasure. And that is one of the most important things to me. The money is a tool that gets me there. It's the side thing. I've never been fixated on, like, I love It's fun to stack money. It's fun to build these things. But I've never been fixated on, I love money so much. I'm Scrooge McDuck. I want to stack whatever. Yeah. I'm fixated on, if I build up enough of that stuff, it lets me do the stuff I actually care about.
Yeah, I love that. I had an interview with Dickie Bush, who, I don't know if you follow him on Twitter. He was working for BlackRock, and he had this epiphany like in his early 20s where he saw a guy like who was 35 or 40, somebody that he would aspire to be eventually, have to ask for permission to go to his son's Little League baseball game. And I think it was like a light bulb moment. He's like, I don't want to live this life, even though I'm making this massive salary. And, you know, who knows how much this guy was making? He's like, this is not what I want. I want optionality. Like you said it.
Man, optionality. It's just, once you, you know, it's as an intellectual exercise, it's fun. But once you actually taste it a little bit, I don't know why anybody would ever not want it.
So I want to get into getting to that point. One of the things and ideas that you and I touched on briefly before we got the interview started was making asymmetric bets. So explain to me how you think about asymmetric bets.
So asymmetric bets, this is a very broad idea and it can apply to a whole bunch of things. I can speak specifically about how I've applied it to my life, but also how what I view an asymmetric bet. And that is, it is some way that you either leverage your time or your money or something. You make a bet, putting one of those things on the line, and the downside is fairly minimal, meaning if an enterprise completely failed, it just blew up in your face, it materially wouldn't affect your life all that much. But the potential upside is maybe limitless, maybe unlimited. It's so massive. It's like, why would you not do this thing? So for me, that has been, for example, early on for me in investing, when I first found Bitcoin, I started investing a little portion of my money into that. If you have $1,000 and you put $900 into what you deem as the safe investment, but you put $100 into what you see as something that has a huge amount of potential possible, but you know, if it goes to zero, you lose $100 and you still maintain 99% of your wealth. Now, I've shifted on my percentages since this, but initially that's how I viewed it. And it blew my wealth up. It rapidly increased my net worth and stuff like that. But another angle that I think is maybe even more interesting is leveraging your time for asymmetric bets. Again, going back to when I was still working a 9-to-5 job and just taking all my extra time and pouring into a side business, you know, what's the downside there? If it failed and it just didn't work out and I'm staying at that job, the downside is I still have my salary. So I didn't lose that unless, you know, layoffs or something happened outside my control. But I still have that. The only thing I lost was just maybe a year of my life that when I gave up the social things, I didn't give up everything, but I gave up some of it. And then the next year I can party hardy and have fun or whatever. It's materially doesn't affect you very much beyond the short term. But long term, it is radically changed my life, you know, building my own business and just getting back into a mindset that I had once upon a time, but then kind of let myself get programmed out of, has opened so many possibilities to where I can't even imagine going back to the other thing.
So let's get into Bitcoin a little bit. Tell me about your origin story there. Like, how did you get turned on to it? At what point did you become, as they say, like red pilled? Talk to me a little bit about your, or orange pilled rather. Tell me about your story there.
I first heard about Bitcoin in either 2012 or 2013. I was big into computer, building my computer and overclocking in this. I was online in like computer enthusiast forums, and I had some friends who I'd chat with about, you get the latest video card, what you check out the new Intel CPU, just very nerdy stuff. And those are some of the first people who ever encountered Bitcoin, because it was the idea that you could take your computer at home and mine, quote unquote, mine this cryptocurrency, whatever that is, and get this thing, and it has some kind of monetary value. And I had a friend of mine who was using his computer just like at night in his off time. And he was mining, like, I want to say it was like 5 to 8 Bitcoins a week, something like that, which he was very excited that he could sell every week for about $30 in total. So he's like, I paid for my video card in just 2 months after doing this. You should do this. I'm like, this is got to be a scam. This is bogus. You can't make money out of thin air. This is so stupid. And I just
wrote it off,
completely dismissed it. Yeah. And then 2014 rolls around, and this is right after the bull run of Bitcoin, where it went up to $1,000 for the first time. And I'm like, that just happened. That sucks. I didn't get involved in that. Can I still get involved in this space? And so I built a mining rig to mine another crypto, and I played around with it, trying to figure things out. And this is when I was working my job, doing my side hustles, building my business. And this is early days of mining and stuff. So every time I come home, it would be like offline and I couldn't figure it out. And I did mine some stuff and I did a few things, but it was just, my head was swirling. So I was like, done, give it up, sell it on eBay, done with that chapter, and ignored it again. And then end of 2016, beginning of 2017 rolled around, and I just kept seeing people online talking about it. And at this point, I'm like, I think there's something here. Started investigating it a bit more, learning, poking around, figuring it out. And I've just bought a little bit here, a little bit there. And then towards the end of 2017, which I know you said was kind of when you first got involved, as that price was running up and up, I was like, oh my God, this is what's happening. I got to be involved. And then I made a series of just boneheaded mistakes, bought at the wrong times, bought the wrong stuff, got involved in just outright scam, lost a lot of money. But going out of that kind of crypto bull run at the end of 2017, the beginning of 2018, as it all crashed back down to earth, and I watched so many people give up and just say, it's a scam, I'm done with it, that you can't make money in this space. This was third time's a charm. Yeah. This was the time that I finally, in my head, I'm like, okay, I lost a bunch of money, very painful, made a bunch of bad decisions. I'm going to learn from those, but there's something here. What is this thing? And I started to investigate and went to the deep end of Bitcoin. Every free dollar I had, I dumped into Bitcoin, all the way from $20,000 down to sub $4,000 and then back up to 12 and then back down to 7. And just when my friends were like, you're going to lose all your money, this is so stupid, it finally clicked for me that what Bitcoin is, what it could be, and what this was akin to, and which in my opinion, it was like if you were in the dot-com bust in the 90s, as the internet, after, at this point, 30 years of existing, is finally starting to get mainstream adoption and attraction. It just had this massive collapse of everything. But if you're one of those people who is willing to pick up the pieces and sort through and figure out what is quality and interesting in the space, because that space is not going anywhere, there's a lot of opportunity there. So that for me was crypto, which is a big part of my story, which of course the cornerstone of that is Bitcoin. And I've just been drinking the Kool-Aid ever since. And now it's a huge portion of my net worth. It's a huge portion of my portfolio. And I've effectively not paid any attention to index funds or traditional investments over the past couple of years. And I've almost 100% gone into this space. And that's where I am at today.
It's interesting to me. It's like you got in or heard about it early enough to see enough of these cycles to know that there are some patterns here that repeat. Yep. It's great that you had the conviction to be like, to be able to buy it, like as it's going from 20 down to 3,500 or whatever it went to, and continue to just keep that high conviction. What was it that allowed you to do that? Who are some of your influences, books, articles, there's a process that I think people have to go through to develop that kind of conviction, whether it's Bitcoin or any investment.
I've read many of the normal books you read for Bitcoin stuff. I've got several on my shelf, like the Bitcoin Standard and stuff. I've read those, and those were certainly influential in helping me understand broadly what it is and how it works and stuff like that. But I think a lot of it was just, and it's really hard to pinpoint exactly like specific individuals or stuff, but I feel like I had seen a series of people who were fairly experienced investors, one, gravitating towards Bitcoin, but two, had talk from experience how they've seen these other things, these big moments in history, these fundamental changes happening. And again, it's just hard for me to not make that comparison and parallel with like the internet in the early days and talking about things like that. And the pieces just kind of slowly clicking into place that I felt like if we're going to have a world that is internet connected and a digital world where we're all moving everything online, why would we not also have a monetary system that is built in that same world? And that started me down a rabbit hole of investigating fiat currencies like the US dollar and others and how they don't last very long traditionally. And the US dollar is one of the longest lasting ones at this point. And that's a little scary, but also starting to learn about how it works. How does the Federal Reserve work? They can print money basically whenever they want and however much quantity they want. And we, as the end user of that currency, we lose our buying power. We are succumbed to inflation and rapidly rising prices and stuff. And so Bitcoin just kept sitting in the back of my head as this idea of maybe this is a way I can actually protect my wealth against those things. And I say this while also being on Twitter at the time during these bear markets and watching every expert and every pundit and every dissenting opinion on Bitcoin talk about how, what a great, hedge against inflation you have here that's down 86% or whatever. But for some reason, I don't know what to attribute this to. I've just been able to zoom out a bit on Bitcoin for the first time in all my financial life and really see a bigger picture instead of just looking at the 6 months or 9 months ahead of me, the 12 months ahead, I started thinking about some of these things in terms of 5, 10 years, 25 years, and where I think our economy in general is going from a macro level, and where I think me on a micro level need to be poised in order to not be completely eroded by these kind of big systems that are in place. And Bitcoin is just the logical explanation for that conundrum for me. And so I just kept reading it about it, watching videos about it, and digging in deeper and deeper.
Did you ever read The Creature of Jekyll Island? Was that one of the books that you happen to read? It's like the history of the Federal Reserve, and it reads like a murder mystery. It's really, really good. And after you read it, you're pissed off. And at that time, when the author wrote it, there Bitcoin, I don't believe, existed. It was like his recommendation was precious metals, you know, for hard currency. Yeah, it's fascinating to see the cycles of it. I remember, this is totally a little off point, but I remember the internet collapse, the dot-com collapse right around 2000, 2001, and Amazon plummeted down to, I forget how low it got, but I remember buying Amazon at $12 a share. And I thought, if it goes up to 16, that's a 30 some percent return. I'm going to sell at 16. That'll be great. And I did, you know, and in retrospect, it's just like, you know, you calculate what that would have been had you just held on to it. And, you know, in hindsight, it's whatever, hindsight's 2020, but I've had the experience of that, and it didn't cost me much at the time, really. But like now I realize it's like these drops are opportunities, you know, where when everyone else is panicking, that's the time to push the chips in and acquire more if you can.
Yeah, I think your analogy there to gold, precious metals, is another big one that kind of hit home for me. As I investigated, again, it's hard for me to tell exactly which people I was listening to at the time, but it was a reoccurring theme that when confronted with the problem of inflation, time and time again, people talked about the power of being in something like gold and a precious metal. But simultaneously, I'm learning about Bitcoin, and in my estimation, it seemed like Bitcoin was the next evolution of gold, which is why people call it digital gold. It has certain arguments to be made about the properties of it. You know, it's not actually physical. You can't use it for other applications like you could gold and electronics or whatever. But many of the other things it does have, where you can transform energy into this pretty hard asset, it's very safe and secure. But whereas gold was tough to move across borders or expensive to handle or whatever, and it's just this cumbersome thing that no one actually wants to transact in, Bitcoin solves all those problems where you can send your wealth across time and space and stuff. And it's just this kind of beautiful picture of where you could sock away your money into this digital gold that has been invented. And you can carry that wealth with you going forward and hopefully withstand the storm of inflation. And I can tell you, just in the past 6 to 7 years that I've been in this space, yes, it has some very dramatic cycles, very dramatic downturns and stuff. But if you zoom out from when I started to where I'm at now, it's just absolutely just sucker punched inflation in the face and blown away gold and everything else. And it's just been this incredible way for me to protect and grow my wealth. But you have to, again, have kind of like a, you know, 40,000 foot view of it.
Couple things. Talk to me about how you deal with the volatility, like seeing it go from 67 down to, I forget where it went, 15 or 16,000. How do you deal with that? That's hard to see your net worth, like in, you know, Bitcoin terms. Well, in fiat terms too. It's like, this is painful. How do you deal with it?
Yes. So I've thought about this a lot. And I feel like for me, there's really three reasons why people panic with that stuff. Because if we talk about the last cycle, Bitcoin hit $69,000. And then at the, which maybe, I mean, it's too early to call, but I'm assuming at this point with hindsight, the bottom was 15,800 right after the FTX collapse and all that. That's a dramatic drop. But I feel like most people who go through those things, they panic and whatever, because number one, they don't understand what they're buying or what they bought into. They don't truly understand the thing that they have put their money into. They heard people talk about it. It's probably people who've watched my channel who just buy into things because I talk about them, even though I constantly say, please do not do that. You have to like investigate this stuff yourself, be curious on your own, just decide if it's a good place for your money. People just buy into things because they think it's going to make them rich overnight, or take your pick. They don't truly understand it. So having a real, true understanding of what you're getting into is crucial to, you know, dealing with these major downturns and stuff, downtrends for the asset. Two, I have the advantage, and I'm not even an OG in the space, but I have the advantage of having 6 to 7 years of experience doing this now. Some people have been in it for over a decade now or whatever, and that's pretty awesome for them. But, you know, the more time in the market, the better your like capability of withstanding these things. Time in the market always beats timing the market, as they say. But truly, the more cycles you live through, the more you understand how it all functions. But then the last thing I would say, and this goes for anything where you're just like, you're watching the price like a hawk and it goes down and you're freaking out, that's oftentimes a signal that you're overexposed. If you're investing money into stuff and it's money that should have gone to your rent or your utilities or your groceries, and you're just dumping it all in and you watch it go down and down and you're like, oh no, I needed that money. Like, you just never want to be in those places. So like, I've learned the hard way with all those things, and I've tried to kind of incorporate those into how I view this stuff. And now I have the advantage of being in the space for a while and having a pretty good understanding of what I have bought into, having that kind of long-term view and not feeling overexposed, even though other people for outside observers would look at how much of my net worth is, you know, Bitcoin or whatever, and go overexposed. I know if it were to go to zero tomorrow, I would be okay. And these are all important things.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey everyone, it's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guys trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash, whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host.
Today's show is sponsored by public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% in APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member of FINRA-SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into a partner bank where they can earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Hey guys, when it comes to financial advice, you've got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever credit card was in my wallet, but I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access, a free flight to a bucket list destination. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and much more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Check out nerdwallet.com and start making smarter financial decisions. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
Yeah, I think that third point, the can't sleep at night, whatever, test is a really good one.
Yes.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you have any price predictions at all for like this next cycle that we're in? Do you have any kind of numbers that you think we may or may not hit?
Well, I was one of the people who was convinced we were going to $100,000 in the last cycle. So, you know, take my predictions with a grain of salt. I do stand with that prediction though, because I was assuming that we'd have the spot ETFs approved in the last cycle, and I thought that was the missing ingredient, and it just did not happen. But we have it now, and I follow the statistics on the inflows of capital and the available Bitcoin that's being bought up by the Black Rocks and Fidelities of the world, and it's, in my estimation, fairly shocking what is about to happen. But I think conservatively, I think this cycle is the one where we see $100,000 Bitcoin. I would not be surprised to see $100,000 to $150,000 Bitcoin, if not much higher, depending on how much attention it gets. But that's my metrics for right now.
Yeah, we'll see. Time will tell, right? Mm-hmm. It's fun times. This is the fun time.
We've just started to embark on the fun time, and I'm here for it.
Yeah. I want to touch a little bit on Bitcoin mining. You said you got into that early on, pushed it away because time stuff and maybe whatever, lack of interest or whatever, but you're back into it now. So tell me about Bitcoin mining, how you do it, just a little bit about what part it plays in your portfolio, how you think of it.
So when I first started meaningfully investing in the world of crypto, I was still in my infancy when it comes to my personal finance journey. So I was really struggling to invest more than a couple $100 per month into all this. I was trying to grow my salary and grow the amount of money I could put into the space. But I was aware and I understood what mining was. And so I was really interested in it and I wanted to get involved. But as things progressed, Bitcoin mining became more and more cost prohibitive, became a bigger thing. And it just was kind of it's kind of far away dream, but I kept thinking about it. And then I went through a full crypto cycle very successfully. And I was able in this most recent one to start jumping into, in a meaningful way, Bitcoin mining. So as of today, across machines I actually own, and then being invested in companies that run machines, and I have a part of those, and then also in publicly traded Bitcoin mining companies through stocks, I've invested about $120,000 to $130,000 into Bitcoin mining so far, which is not as much as I put into Bitcoin directly. But for me and my income and my overall portfolio size, that was a fairly meaningful investment. So that's, I got pretty serious about it. And so far, the experiment has worked out pretty well. I've been doing it for about a year and a half now, and I've mined about 2.5 Bitcoin. And if I had deployed that capital at the time of buying the machines, I could have had a little over 3 Bitcoin. So I'm just short of that. I will hit right under 3 Bitcoin mine before the halving. And then the year following the halving, if things go the way I think they will, I'll probably mine about 4 in total in that year following. So the experiment has been very eye-opening and fun and lucrative so far.
You're not doing it at your home though, like heating your hot water tank or anything like that. You're not one of those guys, are you?
No, but that is super cool. There are people I've followed on Twitter who they heat their house with machines. And a buddy of mine, he used heat exchangers and liquid cooled his Bitcoin miners and heated his pool with his machines, which is pretty cool. No, all mine are at facilities in a few different states around the country, just because my electricity costs here in Austin are a little too high to successfully do it.
Yeah.
And also there's the noise and just power requirements, the infrastructure. It's a lot.
Yeah.
So I have someone else manage all that for me.
Fun. Is that something you think you will continue to do, to dollar cost average into Bitcoin mining? Or how do you think about that? Like directly investing into Bitcoin versus going and buying miners and going that route?
Directly investing into Bitcoin is always the thing. If people are interested in Bitcoin, that's the direction I always recommend, because it's just so simple and you have the coins and there's no added complication. It just makes sense. And it's the proven path. Mining is full of so many unknowns and variables. It is very much an experiment, and you are at the mercy of your entry point in the cycle and different things like that. However, mining is extremely exciting to me for a bunch of different reasons. One, the math, which I model it all the time. I have a spreadsheet modeling the block rewards and upcoming halving and the current price and various things. The math shows that I can actually mine more in total bitcoins than I could have bought buying directly. So that's one really cool aspect. It's not a guarantee. Might not. The jury's still out on that. We'll see in a year or two. But that's really exciting. But one of the exciting parts for me is the hardware arbitrage opportunity. I buy these machines, I mine on them for a year and a half to 2 years. I wait for us to get into a full-on bull market. I wait for pandemonium and everybody's just desperate to get machines. I sell my machines for a profit and I keep all the Bitcoin I mined along the way and potentially even further crazy increase the profitability of the entire enterprise. And then I wait for a bear market. I buy machines again at bottom dollar prices and then I start the entire thinking. Now, this is my first full cycle of doing this, so I might get it all wrong and it might not work out that way. But I have done lots of hardware arbitrage in the past just not to the same degree. And it's been very successful. So that is one of the big motivators for doing this, was seeing how that aspect of this experiment plays out, because I think it could be very exciting.
I like how you're thinking about that. Let's talk about your YouTube channel, and you've also got a podcast. I think you've got a newsletter as well. You're putting out a lot of content. When did you get started with YouTube and realizing the power of YouTube and wanting to create content?
So YouTube, I started in 2015. I started a channel, a cinema channel called Burger Fiction, which is where this that silver play button came from. I was pretty successful. That one has like, it's like 85 million views or something like that. So I learned some of the ropes of building on YouTube. I started that with a good friend of mine.
And what were you doing? You were doing like movie reviews?
Movie reviews, supercuts, where like we did one that is every Jason Statham punch ever and every Tom Cruise running ever, which was a 20-minute video where it's literally showing you every second from every movie he's ever been where he's running. And my God, we would spend 40 hours on a single video, because you have to watch through every movie and the catalog of that person and find every little. So it is an unbelievable undertaking. Some people are like, supercuts, those are dumb and easy, or whatever. It was like a lot of work. And that was fun. And we built, and I was figured out how to build a channel, and I had kind of developed a love for YouTube, but a cinema channel was not a money maker. So I retired that one, still had the love for YouTube. And then I started a personal finance channel in 2020 because my photography business, because of something that happened in 2020, which maybe people remember what that was, caused my business to go on pause for 9 months where I had no work or whatever, which is another moment where I was like, I'm so glad I have an emergency fund. I'm so glad I have investments. I'm so glad I have some passive income going, because, you know, dealing with that type of stuff out of the blue, it's crazy. But I all of a sudden had more time. I wasn't spending all my time on my business. So I finally had the time to put this idea in the back of my head of start a new channel and talk about this love of personal finance you've been developing over the past decade as you've done this journey. So I started Your Friend Andy in June of 2020, and it was personal finance. And I wasn't getting much traction with just talking about best ways to save your money. So I was like, how can I be useful? So I started reviewing banks and credit cards and stuff like that. And then I got traction with those videos because people actually wanted to get an opinion on this bank account, know what all the features were and stuff. And the entire time I was doing that first, probably 9 months to 1 year of the channel doing that type of content, I still had this love of crypto and Bitcoin, but I was scared to talk about it online because I know what the cycles are. And I know the moment that it turns sour, my channel gets no views. And why would I want to talk about a thing like that? But eventually just, I'm just so passionate about it, so excited about it, I couldn't not. And so I did. And that's the moment, of course, the channel blew up. It just tripled and quadrupled my subscribers in a single month, and just views and views and views. And then the crash and the bear market. And then I've been just building for the past year and a half, and finally crossed 100,000 on this channel. But it's super fun. It's my favorite job I've ever had. And as it turns out, if you pick the right things and you're smart about it, YouTube can also be a big time moneymaker.
So go into that a little bit more. How is it monetized? I mean, there's a lot of people listening to this that watch a lot of YouTube, but really don't understand like the background of it all and how a guy like you is making money from it.
Yeah, so it's different for everybody. There is a unlimited ways you can monetize your channel. I choose a couple different ways. There's the base way, which is YouTube pays you for playing ads on your channel. And depending on what niche or which topic you talk about, those rates might be pretty high or they might be pretty low. If you're a gamer and you have millions of views on your channel, you might not make as much as my channel does with only a few hundred thousand views, because finance and this world is just higher up the hierarchy of advertiser interest. And there's ones that are even more lucrative than that. When I was making the banking content and my channel had 5,000 subscribers, the channel is making about $10,000 a month. It is a very tiny channel just because that was such a lucrative niche. But that's not just from the ads. I was also doing affiliate links and referral links. So if someone signed up for a bank account that I was recommending, some of those banks give you a kickback for sending a friend or family or whoever their way, and someone opens an account, you get $100 back. And if you do that on scale, and you put a video out there that's working for you and the platform's pushing in front of people, you make money. And then the big other way I've made money with YouTube is just sponsors, people who reach out directly and say, hey, I have a product or a service or a company and I want you to talk about it. And, you know, traditionally I've said no to 99% of those because a lot of it is junk and a lot of it isn't great, but there's so much quantity. I do find ones in there I do really like, and then I work up a partnership with them. They pay me directly. And maybe even on top of that, I get a referral. That's like the three main ways I've monetized it. But now I have another way, which is I have a private membership community. You can see there's channels who sell merchandise or they sell digital products or courses. I mean, I don't do any of those things, but there's like unlimited ways you can do it. And every single one of those is its own standalone income stream that if one of them starts dipping one month, the other one might compensate for it. So not only do I have multiple passive income streams or income streams in general, like, you know, YouTube and my other business and crypto passive income and my investment appreciation, but each one of those has 5 to 30 individual streams within it. And I really, that's one of the things I love about YouTube and a lot of things I'm doing is I love that compartmentalization of having all these streams in these different categories and having that redundancy and having a very robust way to make money.
When did you sever your ties with your full-time job and leave and to pursue all this? You're doing a lot of creative things and people need time to do that. So when did you leave behind your W-2 job? What year was that?
2014.
So it's been a while.
Yep. And then after that, I did my small business for 11 years and I just retired that. I shut that down completely 2 years ago now.
Got it. So I think they say like the average millionaire has like 7 streams of income. It sounds like you've got 30 at least.
The crypto passive income one is like 30 sources by itself. The YouTube one is at least 4 or 5 streams. Yeah.
It's pretty wild.
Yeah. Quantity is helpful.
Tell me about your newsletter. How often does that come out? What's it called? What kind of content are you covering?
It's called Passive Bytes. And it's funny to ask how often. It's supposed to be a weekly newsletter. Some weeks I miss or whatever. It's a little bit at my own discretion. It's two things. It's one, it's sharing, you know, passive income opportunities that I'm looking at or considering. But two, it's also just kind of sharing my thoughts on building streams of income, building wealth, investing or whatever, things that I think are helpful that I wish I could have kind of read at my various stages of my journey to get here. But really, I don't know what it is, because it's one of those things where I was told by a lot of really smart people, you need to have an email newsletter and you need to have this whole thing. And so I just did it because it was smart to do. And I'm figuring it out as I go what it should be. I've had fun with it. And I think people do like it, but it's an ever evolving animal.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. Do you find you're pretty transparent and open about everything you're doing, the numbers, things like that? Do you find there are downsides to that? Or have you experienced downsides?
My family doesn't like it. They think it's pretty weird and maybe not a great idea. You know, I see there's multiple sides to it. On one side, especially being in the world of crypto, having good OPSEC or good operational security is very important, because you don't want people to know exactly how much you have in your wallet so they can attack you specifically and try to get your money. So I wrestle with that side, but I also wrestle with the side that, especially for the 9-to-5 world, becoming friends with people and then finding out after several hanging outs and several lunches and stuff, we get real comfortable and we talk about our salaries and stuff and, you know, realizing, oh, we do almost the same job and they get paid $20,000 more a year than I do, or having a conversation with somebody who does something more than me and finding out I make more than they do and then being bummed about that, and just how in the dark everyone is all the time about things with involving money in our culture, that aspect too. But also wanting to share these things, because I think transparency makes things more real and makes them more achievable. And I still stand by the fact that I don't believe myself to be special. I think anyone can do the stuff I've done. And if me sharing it gives you a little bit of like oomph or motivation to do it yourself, because early in my journey watching YouTube, I remember watching like the Graham Stephens or the Andre Jicks of the personal finance world, who are the giants in that space now. And they'd share like how much they make in passive income or how much they make from their YouTube channel. And my mind just being expanded and going, I want that. I want those things. I didn't go, they're bragging. I'm jealous or envious. I said, they can do it, I can do it, so I'm going to do it. And so part of it is also just me sharing those things, because I really hope truly that people see that and feel that way. But it also gets a lot of hate. A lot of people really get bothered by it and you get both sides. But that's just being online. If you're going to be online, you have to
be prepared for that. Yeah, you got to be prepared for that. Talk to me about, you had mentioned Kevin Kelly's 1,000 True Fans. Talk to me a little bit about that idea for somebody that's not familiar with it and how you think somebody could do what you are doing if they have 1,000 True Fans.
Yeah. So Kevin Kelly, if people don't know who Kevin Kelly is, you should definitely go look him up and just check out all his stuff, because he's such a cool guy, definite innovator, early adopter, smart guy, successful. But he's also had some just really impactful ideas on me, which namely 1,000 True Fans, which is maybe his most famous online written piece. But it's the idea that anyone can make it in this new digital world if they can just find 1,000 true fans, 1,000 people out there who really love what they're trying to do and what they're trying to share and are willing to come along on that journey with you and support you in some way, whether it's like buying your t-shirt or subscribing to your channel or buying your membership or whatever, that anyone can make it out there if they can find 1,000 people just like that. And 1,000 is a little bit of a daunting number, but it's also a very realistic number simultaneously, because there's YouTubers with millions of subscribers. I don't know if I'll ever get to millions of subscribers, but I can tell you once upon a time, 100,000 subscribers seemed like a faraway idea. And now I'm there. You know, my first 1,000 was a struggle to get there, but I got there. And it just was this idea that I kind of latched onto that said, if I could just do this, I can make this whole thing work. And so far, it has absolutely been proven true.
What advice do you have for someone who is just getting started? Like, what would you tell them, like, to keep pressing on, and how to do this the right way? Like, what would you say to somebody?
So there's a saying in investing, and I think it applies to more than just investing, which is scared money don't make money. And I love that, because almost everybody you encounter in life, everybody you would lump into the realm of having average lives or mediocre lives, and they're not particularly happy or particularly unhappy. They're just going through life doing their own thing, which, you know, is good and bad. I'm not trying to dismiss that. They're almost overwhelmingly doing things that are within their comfort zone, and that's why they're where they are. And so if you want to do anything that's outside of the average or outside of the mediocre, and you want to do something that is, you know, off the beaten path or different, you're going to have to do something that's scary or something that's risky or something that makes you deeply uncomfortable on a multitude of levels. However, if you're able to internalize the upside and really believe that it's worth the embarrassment or the other downsides, which those are real things. I was very embarrassed early on with a lot of the stuff. Then you should absolutely chase that, because let me just tell you, it's one of the best decisions I've ever made in my entire life. If you watch my early videos on the channel, I'm very uncomfortable. I speak like a robot. I'm very slow to speak. And that, even that was me having experienced my previous channel. And that's how bad I was at the beginning. But I still just pushed through it because I had this dream or this idea of what this could mean for my life. And I think that if you're going to chase that, it has to be more than just, it's going to make me a lot of money. It's got to be something you actually like think is going to be just a blast to do. But if you have ever had that thought and you aren't doing at least something to act on it, you're doing yourself a great disservice, because the last thing you want in your life is to be 80 years old on your deathbed and looking back on things with major regret. That's one of the most scary and terrifying things I can think of. And that's been a huge motivator. I refuse to get to the end of my life on my deathbed, if I make it that far, and look back and go, I really wish I had done this. Or, oh, if I'd only done that, if I'd only seen this, if I'd only tried this. And it truly, it's so like trite, but it's like, I would rather try to do those things and just fail than just never have tried them before. And that's always been a stronger emotion than the fear or whatever. So if you can just get over that fear, man, it can be so good.
That is a great place to stop. I really appreciate all your insight here, and talking has been really fun. Is there anything we didn't touch on that you wanted to talk about?
That's, if you can digest a little bit of that and run with it, then my job here is done. I'm happy.
Awesome. So for our listeners that want to find out more about you, your YouTube channel, follow you on Twitter, what's the best way for them to do that?
Just hop on YouTube and type in Your Friend Andy and you'll find my channel. And then from there, you can find my Twitter and my newsletter and everything else.
Awesome. Andy, thanks so much for your time. This has been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, folks, that's all I had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I'll see you back here real soon.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to follow Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and never miss out on our episodes. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.